This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
I really appreciate so many of you coming out on a Friday night to hear some academic material, but I hope God glorifying material as well. It's a very nice turnout. But I'm not real proud about that because I know that many of you probably wouldn't be here were it not for the baseball strike, right? So, how many of you would have been at a baseball game tonight if they would have been playing? I'll see how nice you are. Thanks for making me feel good. I really do appreciate you coming. It's nice to have a big turnout. The one disadvantage is sometimes it's not as personal, and I want you to know that even though I'll be resting my voice and looking at my notes between sessions, I would like to get to know you and shake your hand. And so whenever we have the opportunity, please don't hesitate to come up and talk. I'll try to answer your questions, if you don't mind, during the question and answer period tomorrow. If we don't get to one that you're interested in, I'd be happy to stick around tomorrow as long as need be to answer whatever I can. I can't answer them all, but I'll make an effort at it. Our conference this weekend is entitled Getting Down and Dirty. And the reason for that is I'm convinced that when people make their objections to the Christian faith, the challenge about the Christian faith, that very often they don't know very much about what they're talking about. They're happy enough to just give a generalized criticism of Christianity or a generalized reason why they don't have to take Christianity seriously, and they don't get down and dirty. And so I'd like to teach you that this is something you need to do. In fact, by the time you get done tomorrow, if God blesses this effort, you will be completely convinced that the unbeliever, if you'll just push beyond the surface criticisms that the unbeliever has, the vast majority of cases, I don't have a statistical analysis, but I would guess 98% of the time, what you run into, people will throw something out there, and if you'll do a little bit of analysis of it, you'll find that absolutely crumpled. The reason for that, well, there are many, I'm sure, but I think one really big reason is that we live in what might be called the soundbite generation. People do not, in our generation, think very much. And I could easily fill the first hour, I'll be careful not to do this, I could easily fill the first hour just talking to you about the deplorable state of modern education. Modern education does not teach our college students, much less our high school students, to think clearly. I don't know, I have the articles in front of me, but I do know that the statistics are very high in the number of students who graduate from high school who can't even write a decent paragraph. And you know what it takes to write a decent paragraph? One, you need to know the structure of the paragraph. You need to know why that paragraph's there. There's got to be a reason for that paragraph being exactly where it is and every sentence in it. Now, if people cannot write, believe it or not, they cannot think. Because if you can think clearly, you can express it clearly. We live in a generation where the vast majority of people graduating from high school cannot write clearly, they do not think clearly. In college anymore, it's hardly ever required that people pass the course in logic. I'm not just saying that out of some kind of professional jealousy that, oh, they sign up for the business courses, they sign up for the English courses, whatever, and they don't sign up for those courses Dr. Bonson likes. There's a little bit of that in there, perhaps, but, you know, there was a day where everybody had to be able to think clearly. Now, it wasn't just because you were going to be a philosopher. You were expected to think clearly if you were a scientist. You were to think clearly if you were a historian. Clear thinking, cogent thinking, knowing how to look for evidence for your convictions is one of the things college is supposed to give to people. But it isn't happening. But it's not just in educational circles, high school, college, whatever, that people don't think very deeply or very analytically anymore. Because of the way in which the news is packaged for us, we have all become habituated to the idea that very big, momentous issues can be presented to us in 45 seconds. That's the soundbite generation. And so if you have political issues being debated, you will find that no one ever wants to follow an argument that takes three steps and then a conclusion. It's straight in your face, 45 seconds, get an impression, get a feeling, and you're out of there. The news is presented that way. Politicians present things that way. If you read the newspaper, how many times do you find the newspaper give you a paragraph that's more than a sentence, or maybe two? You know, there was a day, if you go back and look at old newspapers, you see these long paragraphs, you know, because people were expected to follow from beginning to end. But they don't. In fact, people are taught to write newspaper articles today, where because editors want to do work on them and so forth, and they never know, you know, how much space it's going to fill, they are to write them in such a way that there is no clear beginning and end. And you'll see editors will juggle things, and they'll take things and shift them up, drop things out, because every sentence, which is usually a paragraph, has got to be pretty much self-contained. Well, like I say, I could go on and on about this. My concern is that this has worked its way down to the level where we do apologetics, and we're willing to let people give us a soundbite criticism. And we say, well, what are you supposed to do about that? Well, here's what you're supposed to do about it. Get down and dirty. Push for some details. Ask some questions. Those of you who've been to my seminars before know I like to use the example of Columbo. You know, act like Columbo. You know, it's not as though you want to challenge a person straight out, you know, toe to toe, you're wrong, I'm right. But just ask some questions to say, well, explain that a little bit to me. And, oh yeah, there's just one more thing. Now, how does this work together? I'm not quite sure when you back there said this, how that fits into what you're saying now. You need to learn to cross-examine, to push, to do it politely, to do it the same spirit that Jesus would do it. That doesn't mean there's never a time to get intense. This last week, I was doing a seminar on Michael Martin, who's perhaps the leading anti-Christian scholar in our country today. He's written a long book on atheism, another book, The Case Against Christianity. And I began the seminar by telling the students who had come that they should expect that from time to time I was going to get pretty hot and bothered. And that's because the Lord Jesus Christ is worthy of defense. And when people say things and overreach, when they start showing a dogmatism for which they do not have credentials to back up, when they show that they do not know what they're talking about, there's good reason to be upset with that kind of arrogance, especially when it's directed at the Lord of glory. I'm not a very important person. I know that very well. God has hammered me enough in my life that I realize that the only thing that makes life worth living is pleasing Jesus. And so when I see people start attacking that this one who has given his life for me and is the only reason for me to live, really, that can make you upset. So there is a place sometimes when you're talking to people to give it back to them. But you see, if you look at the life of Jesus and the way he dealt with people, you'll see that he was willing to differentiate between those who were religiously arrogant and who needed to be broken, even with some pretty tough epithets directed at them, and then those who had honest questions, those who were weak and who knew their weakness and were humble enough to hear what he had to offer. So I realize you're going to have to adjust your approach to the person you're talking to. I'm not going to give you generalized, here are the four spiritual laws for apologetics. Now go out there and apply them to anybody that's there. It won't work that way. But when you do talk to people, the one thing all of you need to do, no matter who it is, whether it's an intense presentation, a casual cup of coffee, answering questions over a number of months, whatever it is, keep getting down and dirty on the details. Don't let a soundbite scare you away. And we're going to be looking at five of the major soundbites that are used against the Christian faith today in this conference. The sixth presentation is a more generalized approach to what I call the mushy-mindedness of the quasi-atheist. Tomorrow we'll hear what a quasi-atheist is. Most of the people in our society are quasi-atheists. And I want to talk to you, after we've had five specific issues presented, I want to talk to you about how you can deal with the general religious and philosophical problems of our generation. Tonight we're going to begin with the first major criticism is directed against the Christian faith. If you were to do a statistical analysis, if you were to count up the number of times people and say, well, you can't believe the Bible because, and then you know, fill in the blank. I'm fairly confident that what you would find at the top of the list statistically is the theory of evolution. That the main reason in our culture people think you cannot trust the Bible is because its doctrine of creation has been discredited. Now, there are some people who are willing to hold on to as much of the Bible as they can and be evolutionists. I realize that. And that in itself tells you something. Because there are people who feel that we have been so beat up, and from the scholarly standpoint, and academically about the theory of evolution, that if they're going to hold on to their faith, they're going to have to be evolutionists and Christians somehow. Now, that's kind of like an oxymoron, I think. You know, like military intelligence. Those two words go together. Evolutionary Christian doesn't fit into what the Bible teaches, as I see it. But many people won't take that compromised position. They'll just say, well, the Bible's been discredited. But what can you do about that? You know, and often enough, they think that that settles it. And the reason they think that settles it is because they have been taught, or they've somehow picked up by osmosis, maybe in the atmosphere of our day, the zeitgeist, the spirit of our times, tells them that everybody knows man evolved from lower life forms. The Bible doesn't say that. And so, if you can't trust the Bible at the very beginning, how can you trust the Bible on anything else it has to say? Theory of evolution is perhaps the greatest and most persuasive icon of anti-biblical and anti-religious scholarship in our culture today. People will accept its truth and its mitigating effects on the credibility of the Bible, and they'll do that without reflection, actually deferring to the priests of academia to sustain this faith they have, this commitment to the theory of evolution. And I'm here to tell you tonight, Christians should not be browbeat by that soundbite, oh, you can't trust the Bible because of the doctrine of evolution or the theory of evolution has discredited the teaching of creation as it's found in the Bible. You should not be browbeat by the snide or by the widespread polemics of evolutionary dogmatism. Christians need to show a willingness to stop and say, let's ask some questions about this theory before we take it for granted that the scholars of our generation have proven it. You need to be willing to get down and dirty over this challenge to the credibility of your faith. Tonight I want to look at three crucial phases in the evolutionary fairy tale. I think these three phases of the evolutionary story or its tale warrant exploitation by those who want to be defenders of the faith. Those who would criticize the theory of evolution will do well to remember the amoeba level, the ape level, and the atom level. That is to say, I want to look at the problem of bridging the gap from non-life to life. Well, I have to apologize. Any of you who came tonight because you had a real interest in amoebas, I'm really not going to talk about amoebas. That just fit into the alliteration of the title, so I thought that was enough. But what if most of you know about amoebas? We think of amoebas as one of the most primitive small forms of life, right? Elementary forms of life. And I'm actually going to go back beyond the amoeba, so if you're here just for the sake of amoebas now, I guess, because I'm not going to say much more. But at that level of moving into the most elementary step that life is supposed to evolve, you need to ask questions about that, exploit that. And you need to ask questions at what we can call the ape level as well, bridging the gap from one type of organism to another. How do we get apes and giraffes and whales and birds and cockroaches and all those sorts of things? As you know, that was supposed to be the great splendor of evolutionary theory, that it could finally explain the grand diversity of types of life forms. You need to be able to ask some questions about that, because evolutionary theory completely fails at that point too. And then thirdly, what I'm calling the Adam level. Now, in the Bible, Adam is a historic person. And I believe that that's what we as Christians should hold to, that Adam is not just a type of mankind, Adam is not just a mythological picture of the first man, but he was actually our first father. So that's my conviction. Nevertheless, I'm using in the title the word Adam for the step from the ape to the human level in the tale of evolution, bridging the gap from physically qualified characteristics in the animal realm to non-physically qualified characteristics in what we now call man. Man who is intelligent, man who makes moral judgments, man who has self-consciousness. All right, so you understand the title. You can remember it's alliterated, and then remember I'm not going to talk about anything in the title. Amoebas, we're not going to talk about. Apes, we're not going to talk about. Adam is a historic person, we're not going to talk about. But they do represent levels in the story of evolution. Where did life come from? Where did the diversity of life forms come from? And how did we get to the non-physically qualified characteristics of one organism that we call man? So let's begin at that first level. The amoeba level. The smallest living things. Actually, my interest is in the first living cells. In 1953, we saw the publication of two momentous scientific reports, which thereafter have received wide acceptance in the scientific community. Nevertheless, there's an ironic effect because of these two publications. The first was the double helix model of DNA proposed by James Watson and Francis Crick. As you know, DNA is taken as the key to life's diversity. Hereditary information is transmitted across generations by means of a code that is resident in the specific sequence of certain constituents of the DNA molecule. And the great contribution of Watson and Crick, of course, was to show a structure whereby what we knew about the transmission of these characteristics could be accounted for, the double helix model. The other thing that was published, the other article that was published in 1953, was support, experimental support from Stanley Miller for the first step toward confirming a theory of prebiotic evolution. Prebiotic evolution. The biological aspect of the evolutionary story begins when life comes about. And then the question is, how does life sustain itself? How does it diversify and so forth? But as you might imagine, you can't just start the story with life. There's got to be a prebiotic phase of evolution too. And so in 1953, Stanley Miller took what was thought to be the first step for confirming a theory of prebiotic evolution, where simple chemicals interacting at random in a primordial ocean somehow caused the amazing complexity in the molecular organization of living cells. And so one of these discoveries in 1953 was about life structure. The other one was about life's origin. Little did the scholarly world at that time, at that point, stop to recognize and to appreciate the tension that it was implicit in those two revolutionary insights. That is to say, can you start with Stanley Miller's work about prebiotic evolution and end up with the Watson-Crick result of the DNA molecule? That's the question. Any secular theory of evolution requires an account of a prebiotic stage of Earth's development where chemical evolution somehow causes life to originate without supernatural intervention. There must be an evolutionary preamble to the biological and more popularly attended to phase of evolution. Before people talk about apes and giraffes and how living things evolved, they need to explain where life came from. That's the amoeba step in your evolutionary cross-examination. Could you explain to me how we got amoebas? Where did life come from these simpler chemicals? The question is it plausible that unassisted matter and energy organized themselves into living systems? Is it plausible that the earliest living things came into being by the variation of natural forces acting upon matter over long periods of time? Could life, with the impressive complexities of proteins, nucleic acids, and other biological molecules, could life have appeared de novo out of lifeless, inert, simple matter? So that's the Columbo question. One step in the story here now. How did we get from chemicals in the prebiotic oceanic soup to the first living cells? Stanley Miller, using an electric discharge apparatus, identified several racemic protein-forming amino acids. Subsequent simulation paradigm experiments for an environment that was thought to be similar to the primitive Earth's environment, the precursor to the first living cells, went on to yield some detectable amounts of most of the major kinds of biochemical substances. And that, you see, seemed to set the stage, people thought, for suggesting a plausible theory for the uniformitarian, gradualist, spontaneous generation of living matter from simple molecules. That is, setting the stage for discovering a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life by purely chemical and physical means. Here are some problems, though. And I'll label them for you because you may get a little bit lost. I apologize to you if you've forgotten your high school chemistry. The first part of this lecture may be a little tough going. But I did that on purpose. I do enough public speaking to realize you can scare people off and get too technical. So I'll warn you. I'm going to get technical for a while here. All right? If you need to look up some words or go back and review your chemistry textbooks, that's fine. But it's only going to be a little while. It's kind of like, you know, this is only going to hurt for a little. And then we're going to go and get an ice cream cone. You'll all feel better. Second lecture will be real easy to listen to, so at least you'll be able to go home and sleep tonight. So I've warned you, for a little while, I'm going to put on the thinking cap here, and let's ask some tough questions. The first problem that you need to be aware of is that current laboratory and theoretical research has reached an impasse on the prebiotic evolutionary theory. An impasse. And by an impasse, I don't mean everybody is wondering, how are we going to finally get enough information to figure this out? They've reached an impasse where they're not even sure what kind of research could solve the problem now. And this is according to Dean Kenyon, who is a professor of biology at San Francisco State University. And interestingly, the co-author of Biochemical Predestination, a book published in 1969, which was real exciting stuff about how we're going to see how chemicals predestined, you know, the origin of life and so forth. And he now says it's not going to work. Why is that? First of all, there's an enormous gap between the simplest living cells, which have an amazing structural and biochemical complexity. There's an enormous gap between the simplest living cells and even the most complex protocell model systems, which have been produced in laboratories. The likelihood of closing that gap, according to Dr. Kenyon, by artificial simulation of chemical events, those that are thought to be parallel to the primitive Earth, is dubious. He asked this question, what is the pathway for the prebiotic synthesis of relevant organic substances? Here we're thinking of things like purines, pyrimidines, polypeptides. He says, I just want to know the pathway. How is it you get from these chemicals over here and you get these basic things like polypeptides? The experimental conditions in the studies that have been used up to this point have been so artificially simplified, he says, as to be irrelevant to the processes on the primitive Earth. It's entirely implausible that on the primitive Earth, unlike laboratory attempts at reaction mixtures, it's entirely implausible that a prebiotic mechanism for the condensation of free amino acids into polypeptides occurred free from the contamination of substances like sugars and aldehydes. Now, again, you may have to go back and look up some of those words. To make it very simple, he's saying the primitive Earth, you will not be able to screen out the influence of sugars and aldehydes and what's going on in the chemical soup. In the laboratory, however, the artificial conditions have been created where sugars and aldehydes are not going to cause complex reactions. In the presence of these kind of contaminants, polypeptides could not have formed, however. Interfering cross-reactions between amino acids and sugars would yield instead complex and insoluble polymeric materials, which would not aid chemical evolution at all. So if you're taking notes, and a lot of this doesn't sound familiar, all he's saying is, and this is a man who once supported the theory, is he's saying, because of the presence of aldehydes and sugars, you're never going to get polypeptides. Not going to happen. So what's the pathway? How are we going to get around that problem? Moreover, he says there's no explanation even remotely plausible after prodigious efforts over these years for the optical isomer preferences that are found universally in living matter. You know what isomers are. How many of you know what isomers are? Uh-oh. Isomers are two chemical forms that share the same number of atoms and the same substances, but they're organized structurally differently. Okay? So some of you maybe popularly read about left-hand sugars and right-hand sugars, which is just a convenient way of talking about the chemical structure of things. When you have two chemical components which are different from one another, even though they have the same number of atoms and the same substances in them, they're called isomers. Now, here's the problem. When you look at isomers, they're sometimes labeled L-form or D-form isomers. And in living matter, Dr. Kenyon says, the thing that is utterly baffling is that you have L amino acids rather than D amino acids in proteins, and you have D sugars rather than L sugars in nucleic acids. In every living form on the face of this earth. They said, what plausibly could, how could you explain that when you have what's happening by way of random chemical interaction? Why is it that the pathway to life puts D-form isomers in one kind of thing and L-form into another, and that every living form has that? He asked, what's the origin of genetic information in biopolymers? Okay, so polymeric forms in living forms. He wants to know, what's the origin of genetic information, the biologically relevant information? Take DNA. Even if you could explain all of the acids and other things that go into that molecule, the thing is, that's amazing about the molecule is that it's coded. It's got information put into it. And no experimental system yet devised gives even the slightest clue as to how these biologically meaningful sequences of subunits might have come about in prebiotic polynucleotides or polypeptides. The minimal spontaneous sequencing for which there is faint evidence, he says, doesn't have any biological significance. You can get some sequencing in lab experiments, but all the sequences that have been created have nothing to do with life. So he says that isn't going to help. It's as though I had, maybe back in my motel room, isolated myself from all the other interferences that might be out in the real world, if you will, and I built a very small house of cards. And when I got done, I said, see, there that proves it. I could build a house on the Golden Gate Bridge. You'd say, well, but you see, the problem is cards are not relevant to building a house, unless you mean a house of cards. And the fact that you might make a small structure when there's no atmospheric interference isn't going to help you a whole lot when you get out onto the San Francisco Bay, where you have just gusting winds. And so Dr. Kenyon has pointed out that even if you could get some sequencing, it has no relationship to what you're supposed to be proving. So there's the first problem. Somebody like Dean Kenyon says, laboratory and theoretical research has come to an impasse on prebiotic evolution. Secondly, the speculative scenarios offered in prebiotic simulation experiments, which you'll find reported in the chemical evolutionary literature, are flawed and implausible, according to Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson in their book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, published in New York in 1984. Based on geochemical assessments, both the atmosphere and the various water basins of the primitive Earth contain destructive interactions which would have vastly diminished, if not altogether consumed, essential precursor chemicals, so that it turns out the rate of evolution, even if it would have started at all, would have been absolutely negligible. Moreover, these men have shown that the soup, as we popularly call it, would have been too diluted for direct polymerization to occur. And that is the case even in local ponds, which might have tended to concentrate the ingredients. Okay, don't fall asleep. I'll explain this. If you're going to get the chemicals that are necessary to interact We don't have a pathway to life yet, but let's put that problem aside. Another big problem is you can't get those chemicals in concentrated enough forms in the early Earth because of the atmospheric things like rain and so forth would have so diluted them. So prebiotic evolutionary theorists will tell you things like, well, you can imagine a situation where you have a big body of water and part of the water washes out and leaves puddles. And then the water comes back, and so we have a high tide. And those puddles are not affected because they have heavier chemicals, and so eventually you get concentration in the puddles, so that finally you can get the, you know, chemistry of life going. But these men have shown by geochemical assessments that that would not have happened. The early soup would have been too diluted. And there's no geologic evidence indicating any organic soup, even as small as an organic pond. There is no, zero, nada, no geological evidence that any chemical pond ever existed on the face of this planet. The hypothesis of a prebiotic oceanic soup of organic chemicals is simply a myth. It's put in there because the story would be incomplete without it. Moreover, the illusion of even slight success in experimental studies of chemical formations in an early Earth environment have been shattered by what is taken as the illegitimate interference by investigators. That is, the interference of information carriers. When you do experiments, and the way in which you set up the experiment or run it calls for an intelligent person to interact and make the experiment possible, but you don't have an intelligent person to do that on the early Earth, then this isn't going to work. And it turns out that all of the experiments are flawed with illegitimate information intrusion into the experiment. Moreover, the notion that Earth was an open system with energy and mass flow originally, so that you can discount doubts arising about the laws of thermodynamics. Very simply, one of the old arguments against evolution is, well, the second law of thermodynamics says everything moves to a state of disruption, or it doesn't come, you don't get more complex without energy flowing into a system. You get the breakdown of complexity and the breakdown of heat. Is the second law of thermodynamics. And so how could evolution ever explain increasing complexity in life forms? The second law would say, no, you don't. The answer to which is, I mean, the answer that is offered, I'm not satisfied with it, is, well, there must have been an influx of energy into our system. This must be an open, not a closed system here on planet Earth. But the notion that Earth was an open system with energy and mass flow still cannot adequately account for the configurational entropy work of coding that took place in the DNA molecule. That is, it takes some form of energy to do the coding. And as these authors have shown, you don't have enough energy flowing in to take care of the work of coding in the molecules. No sort of coupling mechanism which can generate new information has even plausibly been suggested. So you would need at least something that functions as a template and something that functions as a metabolic motor if you're going to have coding from these chemicals. You all know what a template is? It gives the pattern for things, you know? Once you have a template and you have a metabolic motor so you can use this template and say, okay, all of you molecules organize this way, okay, then you'd be able to get genetic information. But the problem is, no one has even suggested a coupling mechanism. So you could do this. They point out as well that protocells offered by defenders of chemical evolution have only the very slightest superficial similarities to present-day cell processes. The protocell systems are merely conglomerations of organic molecules which offer no steps to bridge the gap between non-living and living things. These protocells, moreover, are highly unstable. They're unstable, in which case they are not going to do the job. They're not suitable for protracted evolution. Because remember, evolution takes place over long periods of time. Carl's saying, boom. But you see, even these small organic, you know, beginnings turn out to break down almost immediately. Even given the laboratory circumstances where you can get rid of sugars, aldehydes, and oxygen, and you have information input that's illegitimate, Even after that, you get something that breaks down quickly. Well, how are we going to get billions and billions of years of evolutionary development from chemicals that break down immediately? It just is not going to work. And as I told you at the beginning, these drawbacks, these defects in the theory of prebiotic evolution are not simply current lack of information types of drawbacks. No one can complain that scientists haven't solved everything. Okay? There's no problem. There was a time when scientists didn't know as much as they do about diabetes. But no one could say at that point, well, it's going to be impossible to find out anything about diabetes and treating it. No, the day came and they're give us more time and working on it. But in this particular case, we're not looking at something where we have a lack of information. The problem is the information we have makes the other impossible. That's the toughest part. So if you were waiting for the pain to end, it's over. There's a third problem with prebiotic evolution, and that's that the randomness postulate has been thoroughly discredited. The randomness postulate, to put it in layman's terms, that this happened by chance. That there was no intrusion from an intelligent agent to guide prebiotic evolution. The last two books that I have referred to, actually, these criticisms can be found in one of them, The Mystery of Life's Origin, was published in 1984, 10 years ago. And I would like to refer to a book that was published in 1967. Okay, so we're coming up to 30 years on this one. In 1967, the book was published entitled Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution, edited by P.S. Moorhead and M.M. Chapman. In this book, which contained devastating scholarly attacks on neo-Darwinian evolution, and not written by religious people. In fact, these are people who are not particularly concerned about Genesis. All they're saying is the current theory that you're offering is just not going to work. Murray Eden of MIT, no slouch of a scholar here, Murray Eden concluded that we need to, quote, relegate the notion of randomness to a minor and a non-crucial role in theories of origins. That's a devastating addition. It says if there is any randomness, it has to be non-crucial, because if the theory rests upon randomness as one of its premises, it will never work. Why is that? Probability theory shows that the mathematical odds against the chance formation of highly complex molecular systems and structures requires for life, the systems that are required for life, the odds would be outrageously high, calling for a time span, given the suggested pathways of events for prebiotic evolution, of more than 10 billions of years, which no one, even the most radical evolutionist, allows for the age of the Earth. 10 billion years. And so here you have mathematical studies from people who are not religiously prejudiced and say, just not enough time, boys. You're going to have to come up with something else. If randomness is part of the theory, it's not going to work. In the same colloquium, Marcel Schützenberger of the University of Paris stated that the problem of origins, quote, cannot be bridged within the current conception of biology. He's not saying, give us more time, more research. He says, it's a dead end, boys. It cannot be bridged. It's not going to happen. The chairman of that symposium, Sir Peter Medawar, Nobel Prize winning biologist, remarked, and I quote, there is a pretty widespread sense of dissatisfaction about what has come to be thought of as the accepted evolutionary theory in the English-speaking world, the so-called neo-Darwinian theory. These are not Christian apologists. These are not religious people at all. And when was that book published? In 1967, almost 30 years ago. I wonder how many of you even know about that. Isn't that interesting? That's never brought up when people talk about evolution. See, get down and dirty when people talk about it. They say, well, evolution has discredited the Bible. You say, well, were you aware that the mathematicians have shown that evolution could not have taken place on planet Earth? We don't have enough time. You cannot have a random theory and the amount of time given for planet Earth and evolution to work. And that's been known for almost 30 years. Kind of a dirty little secret that is not told to people. Certainly not told to college freshmen when they go away to the state university and evolution is presented as this, you know, monument against the Bible. laying aside path-dependent probability calculations, accurate probabilities for the spontaneous synthesis of complex chemicals can be computed in terms of what we know about the application to living systems of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. The reason why I'm going to get into this just real quickly is because a few of the neo-Darwinians at that 67 conference, of course, were absolutely outraged that these scholars were, you know, coming into their house and making a big mess. And so they said, well, the problem with your calculations is they are based upon given pathways for evolution. So maybe all those pathways are wrong. Give us more time. Don't you love it when you see evolution appealing to faith considerations like that? So we have no idea how it happened, but we're very sure it did. And so you guys who have done this mathematical work, it's all based upon the current theories, and maybe they're all wrong. Now, you'd think somebody would say, maybe I better give up evolution since I don't have any theory to make sense out of it. But they haven't. Well, now we've got worse news for them. Ela Prigogine, a Nobel Prize-winning thermodynamicist, probably saying that five times fast, published in the journal Physics Today, November of 1972, and I quote, "The probability that at ordinary temperatures, a macroscopic number of molecules is assembled to give rise to the highly ordered structures and to the coordinated functions characterizing living organisms is vanishingly small. The idea of spontaneous genesis of life in its present form is therefore highly improbable, even on the scale of the billions of years during which prebiotic evolution occurred." Did you hear that last sentence? See, she didn't doubt that prebiotic evolution occurred, but she said, this is just not going to work. You're not going to be able to do it with these kinds of theories. The laws of thermodynamics make the probabilities impossibly high. Well, that brings me to number four. My fourth point I label disappointment in space. If randomness cannot account for the origin of life, perhaps the inherent properties of matter, such as the bonding properties of atoms, make the appearance of life inevitable over some stretch of time. All right. What I've done in the last few minutes is I've said, you've got to get rid of randomness. The mathematicians have shown it's impossible. You don't have enough time. So people have begun to suggest, well, then it's not random. It's inevitable that life would occur. And you have to look at what's inherent in the properties of matter. And the only thing that's plausibly been suggested is the bonding property of atoms. Of course, Michael Pollanin, who is not at all helping us as Christians, pointed out that given a single and simple property, that is, if you're, just logically, if you're going to talk about one property of matter, the bonding tendency of atoms, if you take a single simple property, such as atomic bonding, there would not be any code sequence in the DNA molecule. The only thing you would get is redundancy. But if you get redundancy, life could never come about. Because, you see, if you only have one factor to account for how things come together, you can't ever have a code or sequence of different types of molecules. They're all going to be the same. Because you only have one factor here. Because that's not going to help you. Moreover, one might ask, as I tried to when I debated Gordon Stein a number of years ago, how could matter have any inherent properties on the atheist assumption at all? Inherent properties in a chance world? When people start talking about the, quote, nature of matter, they've already given up their atheism. I mean, they may not be willing to admit it. But on atheist premises, nothing has a nature. Everything's up for grabs. And so where do we get the nature of matter with its atomic bonding characteristic, what have you? Now, Stanley Miller, remember him back long ago? Well, in 1974, he's not done. Right? Stanley Miller states, quote, "We are confident that the basic process of chemical evolution is correct, so confident that it seems inevitable that a similar process has taken place on many other planets in our solar system." And on the eve of the first Mars landing in 1976, NASA's chief biologist, Harold Klein, asserted that if their theories of origins were correct, corroborative evidence for them would be found on Mars. That is, chemical, organic chemicals would be in some state of the life-forming process when we got to Mars. Now, this is what we love. Science at its best. What made science great in Western history? That it gave predictability. It gave some power to tell us what to expect. And so what you do is you put out a theory, you say, this is what the theory would predict, then you go out and look and see if the predictions come true. So finally, we have a way to do this. We're going to other planets. And we predict, in fact, it was more than a prediction. The reason I quoted is, I wanted you to see the supreme arrogance of these men, who said, we are confident we will find the development of life on Mars. That's science at its best. Prediction tested by experimental evidence. But then we got to Mars and the predictions were all disappointed. Likewise, my friends, Voyager 1 flybys of Jupiter and Saturn gave no evidence to suggest life-generating conditions there. And then attention was turned to one of the moons of Saturn, Titan, which everyone thought would be more hospitable to life. But then Titan turned out to be cold and dead, with a terrible atmosphere, 85% nitrogen, 15% argon, and 1% methanol. Now I realize we have some percentages you have to adjust them. So just where is the stage? But the prebiotic stage of evolution has been thoroughly discredited. Even people who formerly held to it said, we're at an impasse, cannot get beyond it. People have discredited all of the experimental work that's been done on it. The geochemical evidence will not support it. You can't even get it off the ground. The mathematicians say you don't have enough time. Thermodynamics says you can't, in probability theory, expect that this would ever have happened. And then when you say, well, it's inevitable, and you go off to space, and every time they've expected to find life, it hasn't been there. Now, did you know that? Were you aware of that? You need to be aware of that, even if you can't remember the word polypeptide. You need to know this, because when someone's talking to you, either a professor at the university or your next-door neighbor over a cup of coffee, and somebody says, well, but you see, evolution has made it impossible to believe the Bible. You need to say, let me ask you about that. Are you aware about the mathematical problems in theory of evolution? Do you realize the people who held the prebiotic evolution have said that it's theoretically impossible now to come up with a pathway for it? Do you have any idea that, here's a good question. Ask people, say, do you know what DNA is? I mean, if you know that they do, don't, you know, be a smart aleck and ask them. You say, do you have any idea what DNA is, and have you ever, you know, studied even a paragraph or two in an encyclopedia about the complexity of DNA? Don't take it lying down when they say, well, evolution's been proven. That is one of the greatest hoaxes in the academic community today. And it's such a hoax that the evolutionists don't want to debate us anymore. And you know what that tells us? They said, well, we don't debate these creation scientists anymore because they are so mixed up about science that it takes too long to explain to the audience what's wrong. Yeah, I'm wrong. You know? I would gladly debate somebody who was such a Lulu head about Immanuel Kant that I have to take time to explain that to the audience. You know, he'd be a sitting duck for somebody who knows philosophy, if that were really true. If we were as stupid as these people say, they'd say, bring them on. Let's have the fool's parade. We'll knock this guy down and this guy down and this spread this bell and so forth. And finally, those religious idiots out there will stop talking about creation and then evolution. But they don't do that because I think you all know, any of you who've listened to these debates, every single time, pardon me, they get their butts kicked. Because there's just too much wrong with the theory of evolution. And so what do you do? What do you do when your argument's weak? You don't want the people you're convincing to hear the other side, right? Now, I don't happen to have a view of public school where I'm real happy about the idea of equal treatment in the classroom. I'd be just as happy we canceled the public schools altogether. But that's for another conference, okay? On the assumption we're going to have them around for a while, I think it's only fair that what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And so if students in the public school system are going to be taught evolutionary theory, they should also hear problems with the evolutionary theory. I mean, isn't that supposed to be the academic way? In fact, it is usually true, but isn't that the big criticism of Christian education from the secularists? How the students will only hear things from one point of view. Well, then you would think that what they do in schools, they want all points of view to be heard because we're so open-minded and neutral. We just follow the facts wherever they lead us, right? Baloney. They're not going to follow the facts anywhere close to where they would lead you if it's going to lead you to something that might suggest you have to answer to an almighty God. And so the theory of evolution is entirely incredible when it comes to the prebiotic stage. But people aren't being told that. They're being told, we're working on it. Trust us. Let's talk about apes for a while here. Remember, apes in my lecture stand for the most popular symbol in the alleged illustration of biological transition in the evolutionary story. Darwin himself said in The Origin of Species, and I quote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down." End of quote. Right, so here's the man who originated the theory. He said, here's the test conditions. He says, if any organ could not possibly be explained by numerous successive slight modifications, he says, that wouldn't count against my theory, and then we'd have to look at all the positive evidence and get a net result. He said it would absolutely break down. It's gone now. Forget it. If there's any complex organ that cannot be explained this way. And so I'm going to give you a few illustrations. Here I'm relying on a book that I find fascinating, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis by Michael Denton, published by Adler and Adler in 1986. And believe me, I'm just taking a small percentage of the stuff he puts out there for you to consider. He says, consider the flight feather of the bird. Evolutionary biologists near universally maintain that birds evolved from reptiles and that the feather evolved from the scales of the reptile. And so he asked, by what conceivable and scientifically plausible pathway do you get from the scales of a reptile to the feathers of a bird? Because the theory will work only if the feathers are strong, capable of resisting deformation, and capable of forming an impervious vein. Moreover, there has to be a sufficient number of feathers to provide a sufficient surface area to achieve the requisite degree of lift. He says an aerofoil based on the feathered design has therefore to satisfy a number of quite stringent criteria before it can function and create lift. But it's very difficult to understand what the adaptive value of frayed scales from a reptile would be for a gliding organism, when any degree of fraying would make the scales pervious to air, thereby decreasing their surface area and making lift capacity impossible. All known organisms which have adaptations for gliding among fish, frogs, reptiles, and mammals present a continuous unbroken surface to the air. It would seem reasonable to believe that selection for gliding and a hypothetical proavus, that is, a flying organism, would always tend to increase the impervious surface area of its wing and decrease the tendency to fray. So let's put these two together. In order to get the scales to turn into something else, like wings, and form feathers, the scales have got to fray. That makes them what? Pervious to air. In order to get the feather, you have to have an impervious vein in it so you can get a surface area and get lift. And so what we're being asked to believe is we went from something that was pervious to that which is impervious to air. Where do you get the middle step? Where do you get to the place where, I mean, you say, well, it was pervious and then not quite so pervious and then just kind of mushy. And then it was a little more impervious, and then finally it was impervious. You don't get a middle step in there. In fact, he says it's even worse than that. Let me quote for you from Barbara Stahl in her book, Vertebrate History, Problems in Evolution, published in 1974. She's speaking about feathers of birds. She says, how they arose initially, presumably from reptile scales, defies analysis. Not a religious person saying that. Let's consider the lungs of a bird. We have even a greater problem. In all other vertebrates, the air is drawn into the lungs through a system of branching tubes, which finally terminate in tiny air sacs, so that during respiration, the air is moved in and out through the same passage. Now, I realize that this is not the way a scientist would like to put it, but I can make my point. Let's just call this the U-turn lung configuration. You see, in all other vertebrate animals, other than birds, the way in which our lungs are constructed, human beings as well, the air comes in, branches out, finally gets to a sac, which allows it to turn around in the sac, so that in the same pathway, you have air coming in and going out. So you have the U-turn lung configuration. In the case of birds, however, the major bronchi break down into tiny tubes which permeate the lung tissue. And these so-called parabronchi eventually join up together again, forming a true circulatory system so that air flows in one direction through the lungs. All right? So in the case of birds, you don't have the turnaround air sac at the end of the bronchi or the parabronchi. You rather have one direction flow of air. Now, that's true of all birds and only of birds. Now, explain the evolution of birds. Well, they're supposed to have evolved from reptiles, right? Well, what do we know about reptiles? They've got the U-turn lung, not the one-direction lung. How are you ever going to get, no matter what modification you suggest, how are you ever going to get to the place where you can move from the U-turn lung to the one-direction lung? Remember, most animals cannot survive without breathing more than 2 minutes. Well, we need long periods of time of gradual changes where somebody's holding their breath. You know? It just won't work. Michael Denton gives a number of illustrations like that. He says, consider the amniotic egg of reptiles as well. The amniotic egg, when you go to the market, you buy eggs. You know, what are they like? Well, they've got a shell on them, right? The amazing distinguishing characteristic of reptiles is the amniotic egg was supposed to have come about as a result of successive accumulation of small changes. But the amniotic egg in reptiles is vastly more complex and utterly different to that of amphibians. Altogether, there are 8 quite different innovations that are combined to make the amniotic revolution, according to Dr. Denton. The formation of a tough impervious shell, the formation of a gelatinous egg white, and the secretion of a special acid to yield its water, the excretion of nitrogenous waste in the form of water and soluble uric acid, the formation of the amniotic cavity in which the embryo floats, on and on. The formation of the allantois from the future floor of the hind gut as a container for waste products, later to serve the function of a respiratory organ. The development of a tooth or carnicle, which the developed embryo can utilize to break out of the egg. A quantity of yolk sufficient for the needs of the embryo till hatching. Changes in the urogenital system of the female permitting fertilization of the egg before the hardening of the shell. Ain't going to work too well if the egg's already got a hard shell on it, right? And on he goes. And he says, we're supposed to believe these things take place by small, gradual, successive changes. It's just not possible. And he brings up other illustrations. I'm going to give you just one. If you have a weak stomach, you may want to step out of the room for a minute, because we're going to talk about the liver parasite called the liver fluke. He says, consider the life cycle of the liver fluke. And remember, I mean, it's going to be amazing. If you don't know about liver flukes, I didn't know about them, you know, until I read this book. But it's pretty, yeah. But it's not just that. It's long, complex, and seemingly irrational at many steps. And he says, now, what is the life cycle? How are you going to, in terms of evolution, explain the evolution of the liver fluke and this pattern of life for it? The adult liver fluke lives in the intestine of a sheep. After the eggs are laid, they pass with the feces onto the ground. The eggs hatch, giving rise to small ciliated larvae which can swim about in water. If the larvae are lucky, they find a pond snail. They must do this to survive, but the snail is the vehicle for the next stage in the life cycle of the liver fluke. Having found a snail, the larvae finds its way into the pulmonary chamber or lung of the snail. Here it loses its cilia and its size increases. At this stage, it's known as a sporocyst. While in this condition, it buds off germinal cells into its body cavity, which develop into a second type of larvae known as the ridae. These are oval in shape, possessing a mouth and stomach and a pair of protuberances, which they use to move about. The ridae eventually leave the sporocyst, entering the tissue of the snail, after which they develop into yet another larval form known as the characteri, which appear superficially to resemble tadpoles. I mean, already I'm mystified. I mean, all where it's got to stop, it starts in the intestine of the sheep. It's got to be passed out through the waste. It's got to be in a watery environment. There's got to be a snail there. Then it's got to go through the snail system in this way, and it's got to go through three metamorphoses in the snail. Using their long tails, these tadpole-like larvae work their way through and eventually out of the snail and onto blades of grass, where each larva sheds its tail and encases itself in the sheath. Eventually, they are eaten by a sheath. Inside the sheath, they find their way into the liver, where they develop sexual organs, but not until they're in the liver and mature into the adult state. They finally leave the sheath's liver and migrate to the intestine, where then they can mate. And then the extraordinary life cycle begins again. He says, in the case of many of the more dramatic invertebrate metamorphoses, not even the vaguest attempts have been made to provide hypothetical scenarios explaining how such an astonishing sequence of transformations could have come about gradually as a result of the succession of small beneficial mutations. That's the funniest part of all. Is that every step along the way in the evolution, the development of this parasite has got to be a beneficial mutation. Doesn't seem very beneficial to me to get back into the poop of one of these animals. Over the grass, and then into the water, and then into the snail, and then, and only then get sexual organs, then finally get to the liver, then mate in the liver. I mean, what on earth are we supposed to think about this? Except that it's a grand fairy tale for adults. Is it not illegitimate to ask whether we should stop and wonder at the bountiful creativity of impersonal nature? Or should we maybe stop in our tracks and consider the wise, sovereign, and bountiful creativity of the personal God who made this world? You know what happens when you suggest to people that evolutionary theory cannot account for any of these marvels? They'll say, well, of course, we're not very creative. We don't know everything. Nature is a lot more intelligent or creative than we are. Now, when your neighbor says that to you, or even the scientists at the university said, excuse me? Did you say nature was intelligent, creative, bountiful? You see, what you have here is that in the end, the evolutionist is going to ape Christianity. And so we're not going to say there's a personal God, but to account for our theory, we're going to have to talk about an impersonal God. Now, if you were to say, oh, do you mean Mother Nature? I've met her once. Mother Nature? Oh, no. That's a personification. Say, okay, well, what do you mean by the creativity of, quote, nature? What are you talking about? How can an impersonal pond of chemicals be smarter than us? We can't account for, you know, the liver fluke. So you're to tell me that nature does that. Well, one more step here along the way, and we've got to take a break. Adam. Evolutionary theory completely breaks down at the prebiotic stage, completely breaks down at the stage of explaining certain complex organs those of you who've come to my conferences before will say, Dr. Bonson, why didn't you talk about sexual genitalia? Why didn't you talk about the development of the eye? Well, because I've done that before, I wanted to give you more fascinating things like liver flukes this time of year. There are many illustrations, but time's short, we've got to go on. One more step in the evolutionary story that is completely implausible. How do we get to an organism representing the human species, which is notable among all the different species of living things for its mental and moral characteristics? Remember that mental and moral characteristics are not physically qualified. I have to give you a quick illustration of that point because I know I don't have a lot of time left. There are differences in creativity between human beings. You all know that. If I were to say, Johnny, be good for you, you might think that I had a lot of musical ability and creativity. But I know that I can't write music. And the people who do, I think, just marvelous. However, it turns out that if you do an analysis of my brain and a person who does have a lot of creative ability, you're not going to find any chemical components that are different. Nor are you going to get a different complexity of the brain. It just isn't explained that way. Ask any neurologist. So there are things that human beings do which are not physically qualified. You can't account for them as like, oh, well, Mozart must have had a bigger brain, or he must have had a more complex brain. It doesn't work that way. There are advanced linguistic and abstract abilities that human beings have that no other animal does. Now, I realize what your neighbor may say. Well, they're doing tests, you know, out there on Flipper. You know, we're getting all the little honk, honk, honk stuff, and we can see. Well, of course, you know what you can do? You can program an animal. No doubt about that. Some better than others. You can program animals so that when they want something, they know what the mechanism is to get it. And if they have some kind of sounding device or a button they can push if they're an ape, you can do that. I've never understood why people are impressed by that. Big deal. So there are natural correlations that these organisms can pick up on. But you see, they don't write sentences. Well, forget the writing part. I don't want to be unfair. They don't form new sentences. In all of the experiments, the animals can only give back what you've already programmed for them. That's true. When the ape gets hungry, he knows to push this rather than that because this is the thing that brings the food out rather than the water. You can do that. But you see, little children, this is the marvel, those of us who have seen our babies grow up, little children don't have to be taught new sentences. They form them on their own. Granted, the first words are like mommy and, you know, that sort of thing, and usually no, but eventually they get to the place where they start using words and sentences that we didn't teach them. That's the amazing thing about the linguistic and abstract abilities of this human organism. Humans make judgments about moral obligation. And their judgments about moral obligation cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, be reduced finally to predictions about survival value. Now, people have tried to do that. They say, well, ethics is just really a matter of the statement of an expectation, which expectation is thought to be more conducive to life. Well, the problem is, though, for years and years and years, the human organism has had moral systems which are not self-serving and, in fact, self-sacrificial in relation to others. Evolution cannot account for the self-sacrificial nature of some human beings. So how is it that proto-humans, whatever you think they are, let's call them, how did proto-humans become intelligent? How did they become kind? How did they become civilized? Given the operating assumption that all changes are to be explained physically as gradations and always in terms of the benefit that it brings to the organism itself. A quick illustration from philosophy. All of you can think about duckness, right? And all of you have probably seen Huey, Dewey, and Louie. What's the difference between Huey, Dewey, and Louie and duckness? Well, Huey, Dewey, and Louie are particulars, right? You can go out on the pond and count them and say there's three ducks out there. But now when we say there are three ducks, the word duck is not being used as a name. It's being used as a type. Or in philosophy we call it a universal. So we all have the notion of a duck, duckness. And then we look at these things and we say, oh, There's an instance of a duck. There's an instance of a duck. There's an instance of a duck. Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Well, you can account for maybe. Maybe you can account for how we identify this, this, and this. I don't really think the perceptual explanations given by evolutionists make any sense at all. But let's just say for the time being, be kind here. Okay, we'll give you that much. But the point is, you never perceive duckness. No one has ever seen a duckness. You've seen ducks, you've seen horses, but you've never seen the form of horse, or better, the idea of horse, or the concept of horse. Why? Well, because concepts are universals, are not the sort of thing you can see. Now, how does evolutionary theory explain the atom stage? How do we get from organisms which only experience particular things? No matter how many particular things you have, they're only particular. How do you get to organisms that now speak abstractly of universal things, types, general classes of things, universals? How do you account for moral judgments? How do you account for the word ought on the evolutionary theory, especially you ought to give your life for those that you love? How do you get that sort of thing in the evolutionary theory? Well, you don't. Evolution cannot explain amoebas, evolution cannot explain apes, evolution cannot explain Adam. The evolutionary account is the furthest reaches from plausibility, despite its widespread popularity in our society. Evolution is absolutely a theory that should be believed only on religious faith. Evolution basically requires us to believe that distinctive qualities arise from their opposites. All right? Non-life, somehow, shake it up, get all the right combinations, non-life becomes life. And then you get U-turn lungs that turn into one-way lungs. And you get that which is only particular, thinking about universals. That which is only selfish, turning into self-sacrificial organisms. Evolution requires you, at all three of the stages, if you're taking notes and you haven't followed all this, this is the punchline. At all three stages, you'll notice that evolution requires you to believe that a distinctive quality turned into its opposite. And that is absurd. But now understand, before we take a break, my purpose has not been to refute the evolutionary theory. If you mean by refute to compel from the evolutionist an admission of error and defeat, my purpose has simply been to de-scientize the evolutionary theory. I made that word up. But you probably know what I mean. De-scientize. When you see all these problems, the thing that should be obvious to you is that evolution is not a scientific theory. It has remarkably bad credentials as a hypothesis within natural and experimental science. People may indeed continue to confess their allegiance to this theory of origins, deciding on the basis of their own presuppositions and their ultimate commitments in life to de-emphasize the anomalies, to de-emphasize those problems you can bring up, to marginalize the tough questions and call them trivial, to persevere in faith that the problems can be worked out in future research. Give us time. In so doing, however, it must be conceded that we are dealing here with an ideology or a philosophical commitment. We are dealing here with nothing less than a secular faith that is held with religious devotion, as organizing life and its priorities, disciplining one's thinking, and being important enough to suffer abuse for, and even to die defending. And the interesting thing is, those are the attributes that you usually pin on religious theories. They organize life, people's priorities, discipline their thinking, and are important enough to suffer abuse for and even to die for. Evolutionists are religious people. They are not scientists. They put on the white coats and they teach in the university and they don't want people to consider the other evidence and so forth. They may look like they're scientists, but they don't act like scientists. And they have theories which are utterly disgraceful in terms of natural science and its operations. But people will continue loyal to evolutionary faith. And this faith will be bolstered and reinforced by the general adherence to it in our society at large. People will say, well, I can't be wrong, because a lot of people believe in evolution. And that will be enforced by the anointed priest of academia, who, in a strange reversal of the Stokes case, wished to protect the young from hearing confusing counter-evidence to the evolutionary creed. When we see people clinging tenaciously to beliefs which are hard to justify and afflicted with scholarly difficulties of the magnitude that we talked about in just 1 hour lecture here, we should suspect that ulterior motives are at work. Thank you.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.